Right. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Happy daylight savings, losing. I don't know which one this is, if it's the good one or not, but it's the bad one. We lost sleep, but when you have kids, it doesn't matter because you don't gain sleep at the other one because the kids wake up at the same time. Okay. Can I have someone, Brandon, will you pray for us? And then we will start 1 and 2 Samuel. Amen. Okay, so we are continuing to make our way through a survey of the Old Testament. We've used the analogy of a puzzle box. So in putting together the puzzle of the scriptures, first thing you do isn't just pour the pieces out and just start trying to push them together. Rather, you look at the picture on the box first. See, what is this puzzle I'm putting together? And then you look for some corners, then you look for some edges, and things like that. And so that's what we've been kind of attempting to do in these teachings is, though it's painful and we want to dive into the stories, stay as 10,000 feet as we possibly can. We often fail at that, but stay as big picture as we possibly can looking at these books, hopefully to set up our church, one, to understand what are the big themes, what are the messages of these books, and then two, set us up to where there's this almost excitement to dive into the books when we're done here. And so we've been walking through, we finished the Torah, the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, sometimes called Moses 1, Moses 2, Moses 3, Moses 4, Moses 5. And then Lee last week gave an excellent overview of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. An excellent overview of just seeing, one, how the story is progressing, the high point of Joshua, the extremely low point of Judges, and then the hopeful book of Ruth. And today we pick up right after that, right after the period of the judges, and maybe the most, as far as the stories go, there might be a couple rivals, Exodus or Daniel, but as far as like the Bible stories go, one of the most famous book, there are two books in our Bible, but originally one work, there are two works or two books because of scroll length. Your scroll can only go so far, but the book of the Samuels, 1 and 2 Samuel. So we'll look at Saul, we'll look at King David, we'll look at David and Goliath, how we often misunderstand that story, all those fun stories this morning. But we'll just look at kind of three things. We'll look at background and structure, kind of how we've been doing. What is the background? What's the structure of these books? What is the message and kind of main theological point of this book, these two books, one book? And then how does it point to Jesus? So the same sort of things we've been walking through. So first of all, background. Look at the author. The author of the Samuels is unknown, but we do have this passage in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 29. Now the acts of King David, from the first to the last, are written in the Chronicles of Samuel the seer, and the Chronicles of Nathan the prophet, and the Chronicles of Gad the seer, with accounts of all his rule and his might, and of the circumstances that came upon him and upon Israel and upon all the kingdoms of the country. So that passage is referring not to the Chronicles in your Bible, but rather this idea that Samuel and the prophet that we'll see in the Samuels, Nathan, and then another prophet named Gad, and perhaps their disciples, they were in the habit of keeping records. Okay, Carl will teach the Chronicles and the Kings next week, I believe, and you'll see a line after some of the kings die off. There's a line that often shows up. It says, "And are not all the acts of Ahab recorded in the books of," and then we'll basically just let you know, though it's not a book in our scriptures, there were Israelite historians who were writing down what happened during Saul's reign, what happened during David's reign, what happens during Solomon's reign, and there's records, if you will. And so though we don't know the author of these books in particular, we do get little glimpses into how these events were recorded and kept for the Israelite people. Okay, so the date of this book, the events are about 130 years from about 111 BC to 971 BC, the beginning of Samuel's birth. Samuel's birth to essentially the end of David's reign is going to be the 130 years that this covers. And this will take place right after the time of the judges. Okay, so again, think back to Lee's teaching last week, that line we saw over and over again. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. So Lee talked about what's the theme we're looking at in Judges. Israel needs a king. Israel needs a king. Israel needs someone to guide them. When they don't have a king to lead them, things go bad. And not just bad, things go wicked pretty quickly. And we saw that line. That's the theme of the book of Judges. And so the Samuels is given kind of as an answer to that question. Israel needs a king. And Samuel is saying, here is the king. Okay, so it's right after those events. Again, Ruth was during the time of the judges, and Ruth is David's grandmother. We saw that genealogy ending. Okay, so that's kind of the historical background. The structure of this book is really simple. You can just think about it as far as three characters. And yes, I did draw something for you. You're welcome. I know you guys are always like, oh, we just love the artistry of Jared and Lee. So just think about the structure of the book as Samuel, Saul, David. Okay, the focus is going to be first on Samuel for the first couple chapters, then Saul, then David. Okay, it's very clear, focused on the persons. And one of the things you're going to see as we look at, particularly when Saul begins, is we're going to see a rise and fall of King Saul, unintentional rhyme, rise and fall of King Saul, and simultaneously a rise and a fall of King David. Growing up in Sunday school, I would be taught Bible lessons and they would show you pictures, visuals to accompany with it, not as beautiful as this, but pictures to accompany with it. And one of the things you often heard was Saul followed God with no heart. And so you'd have a heart empty. Solomon followed God with a half heart. So his heart was here and he'd have half a heart because he started off good and then went bad. David followed God with his whole heart. And I get what they're going at, but we're going to see in the book of Samuel, that is not true. King David is not the righteous king we're looking for. He is like the righteous king we're looking for. The righteous king we're looking for will come from King David. We'll see, again, as Carl teaches next week in the Kings and Chronicles, even wicked kings, God shows favor, and he will say he'll do it for the sake of King David. King David is a man after God's own heart. Do not be deceived into thinking that means he is not a human being. David is Adam's son, which means David is a sinner. And we will see spectacular sins from the great King David. Okay, so he will have a rise and a fall as well. So that's essentially how this book goes. It is a jam-packed book filled with, again, a lot of these famous stories that we love. So let's dive into the message of Samuel. So this great book about the kings, in those days there was no king in Israel, every man that was right in his own eyes, this expectation from the judges, starts off not with Saul, not with David, as you would almost expect, starts off with a random barren woman. A random woman who's married to a man who has another wife, and she can't have any kids. And so if you're reading the Bible chronologically, you have all this Judges anticipation. You have all this Ruth anticipation. Okay, we got a David genealogy. Who is this random person? And Samuel is very intentional in starting off the Bible that way because this seemingly random woman, Hannah, is going to kind of embody in her life and in her experience the whole message of the book of Samuel. So Hannah can't have any children. She goes to the temple. She cries out to God. She has this desperate prayer, so desperate that Eli, the priest, thinks she's drunk, which is a ironic theme you see in the scriptures. I'll see that in the book of Acts, with the apostles speaking in tongues, the accusation they're drunk. But they're crying out. She's crying out to God, and God answers her prayer, and she becomes pregnant. Now, we've tried to highlight this a little bit. One of the things you see over and over and over and over again in the Old Testament is God keeping his covenant promises through barren wombs. What's the great promise of Genesis 3:15? Through Eve, an offspring will come that will crush the head of the serpent, reverse the curse, and bring us back home to God. And then we see Sarah, who's not just old, but is barren. And then we see Rebecca, who is barren. And then we see Rachel, who can't have any kids. And then we see finally a kid show up in Isaac, and then God says to sacrifice him. And so the pattern we see, even before you get out of the book of Genesis, is God's promises come from life through death. A barren womb that is representative of death, it cannot produce life, and that is the exact womb the Lord is going to bring his promises through. And so we see that again here with Hannah, a barren woman who cries out to God, and God provides the prophet that will lead the nation back to God, Samuel. Again, keep that in mind, as again, all patterns point ultimately to Jesus. How is our Savior brought through a womb that is not meant to produce children? Okay, and so we see that right at the beginning. And as Hannah becomes pregnant, Hannah, in 1 Samuel 2, praises God. He answers her prayer. She responds in a prayer of praise. And this prayer is going to basically set up the whole theme of this book. So it's right at the beginning, 1 Samuel 2. David is going to have a kind of prayer in 2 Samuel 22 that are essentially, they're going to bookend, they're going to mirror each other. They're going to bookend the Samuels. Okay, they're going to highlight the themes. So look at this prayer from Hannah. Again, the seemingly random woman, she says this, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you. There is no rock like our God." Verse 3, "Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. For the bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength." Okay, so I'll keep reading a second, but her prayer is, again, going to introduce a massive theme of the Samuels. Those that look mighty, those that are tall and handsome, Saul, those that look unbeatable, Goliath, will be humbled. The proud will be humbled before God. Verse 5, "Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, and those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she has many children, is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up." Verse 7, "The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust, and he lifts up the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit the seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed." Right there, you have the theme of the whole book. We will see this play out time and time and time and time again. The mighty in the world's eyes, we will see fall in spectacular ways over and over and over again. And the unseen people in the dust, like Hannah here, we will see exalted over and over and over again. Okay, so Samuel's giving you, through Hannah's prayer, the themes of this book. She's almost embodying it in her experience. Again, David's prayer will mirror this in 2 Samuel 22. So Hannah prays, and then the author of Samuel launches into kind of letting you know, what is the state of Israel like? Okay, and it's just like the judges. It hasn't gotten any better. There's still no king in Israel. Every man is doing what's right in his own eyes. Eli is the priest, and he has these worthless sons, literally what they're called, who are leading Israel. They are not performing their priestly duties in a righteous way. They're being extremely selfish and self-centered. Again, painting this picture of there's wicked leaders, and therefore they've led the people into wickedness. And then Samuel comes into the picture, and he is called by God to lead the people, even as a young boy. Okay, so Samuel is going to be, again, he's the first main character. He's going to kind of be a hinge figure. He introduces almost the age of the prophets. He's kind of the first, if you will, prophet. And he's also the last judge. Okay, so he's going to be described as judging Israel. So he's this kind of hinge figure into the monarchy, as we'll see. So we see him being called as a young boy, but then the camera pivots back to how is Elijah in particular, Eli in particular, his sons leading the country. And we get this scene where the Philistines, who are kind of the perpetual thorn in Israel's side, show up. They draw up against Israel in battle, and they're great and they're mighty, a theme we're going to see over and over again. And Eli's worthless sons, what they do as they draw up into battle is they get the Ark of the Covenant and they begin treating it like a good luck charm. So long gone are the days of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy where God is leading in a pillar of cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night. Rather, the ark is kind of being drug along as if they're treating it almost superstitiously. It shows kind of the spiritual state of the country. They're thinking, if we have this, almost like a lucky rabbit's foot, if we have this, we will win. They go into battle, they get routed, and the ark gets stolen. And Eli hears news that his sons have been killed, the ark has been stolen. He falls off his seat backwards, and Samuel lets us know he was a fat man, and he dies. And so this devastating picture of just the state of the people of God, then the very next scene we see is God by himself, if you will, the Ark of the Covenant that the Philistines have captured, they drug into the temple of their god, Dagon, as a kind of similar to what we've seen with Nebuchadnezzar, kind of a way to mock, look, our gods are stronger than their gods. And as they come back in the morning, they see the big idol of their god, Dagon, has fallen down before the Ark. They quickly set it back up, come back the next day, it's fallen again, and its hands and head have been fallen off. And so two things that ought to spring up in our minds. One, though Israel is nothing but a representation of faithlessness and weakness and debauchery, really, we see God very much able to take care of himself, pours out plagues on the Philistines to where they are sending the ark out of their midst. They don't want it as a trophy. They're sending it back to Israel. So God very much is able to defend himself. And then two, especially when you see Dagon's statue fallen and the head falls off, it ought to prick in your mind, where have we seen this before? Where have we seen God? Anytime you see a crushed head, that ought to arise in your heart, Genesis 3:15. Though Israel's state is so dark, they are leaderless, they are superstitious, it looks like they've totally lost their faith, the promises of God to crush the head of his enemy are still true, in spite of man's faithlessness. Okay, so though Samuel is showing you this dark judge's time is still a reality, similarly, the hope in the gospel promises are very much still alive. Okay, so that's what we're seeing in the opening pages. It gets sent, the ark gets sent back to Israel, and Samuel grows up and just begins to lead Israel. And it kind of leads them into a little bit of a renewal, revival, begins to lead them back to God as prophets are meant to do. Prophets are meant to say, okay, let's go back to the word of the Lord. Here's how we've strayed from him. Let's go back to him. And right when it seems everything's going well around 1 Samuel 8, you get this demand from Israel to what? What do they demand? Give us a king. Give us a king. Now, that on its face is not a bad thing. We've seen from Genesis a promise. Abraham was promised, kings will come from you. There's a prophecy in Numbers 24 that a king will rise out of Israel and will crush the enemy's head. Jacob prophesies that Judah, the scepter of the king, will never leave his line. So there's all these kingly promises. Deuteronomy 17 even gives stipulations of when you have a king, here's how he ought to behave. And so on its face, that's not a bad thing. Why is what they ask for a bad thing? There you go. Yeah, I have it underlined for you. So there you go. I set you up for success. They want not just a king. They want a king like the other nations. We look at the Philistines, we look at the Amorites, we look at the Moabites. We want to be like them. Give us a king like they have. Now, if you've read Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, why is that a problem? Say again. God is their king. That's right. And those kings are bad, they're wicked. And what's the whole point of Leviticus? What's the whole point of you can't wear two sets of clothes and you can't eat these types of foods? You are a holy nation. You are meant to be distinct. You're meant to be my people. As a nation, you're meant to be a royal priesthood. You're not meant to look like them. You're meant to be uniquely mine. And here, what is Israel's desperate cry? We don't want to be yours. We want to be like them. Okay, So you see the heart. You see why this makes Samuel lament. You see why this God describes this as a rejection. It's in a sense a rejection of the covenant he's made with them. Okay, they want a king so that they can be like the other nations. Okay, so already this is going to end our first section here of just Samuel. Okay, they're asking for a king. So already we're seeing the themes of Hannah's prayer begin to play out. Okay, who are the mighty that we've seen thus far? The Philistines. And what have we seen in this passage when they encounter the living God? Their God is humiliated. They have plagues all over them. They're begging for Yahweh to leave their midst, right? And what else have we seen? We've seen the lowly, the forgotten, Hannah, and her little son, Samuel, be exalted and begin to lead. So we're beginning to see this play out. And next we get the section of basically Saul's reign that's going to take us through all the rest of 1 Samuel. So all the rest of 1 Samuel is going to be Saul becoming king and Saul all up until Saul takes his own life in a battle with the Philistines. So we see Saul is made king already from the get-go. The author of Samuel is showing you Saul's incompetency. Saul shows up because he's looking for his father's donkeys and he can't find them. And then when Israel chooses him as king, notice the description, 1 Samuel 9, there was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. So he looks good to your eyes. And his shoulders upward, he was taller than all the other people. And so what are they valuing in Saul? His outward appearance. I look at the Philistines, they scare me. And so what do we need? We need someone bigger and badder, physically, that might actually go bring us victory. What did the spies in Numbers, as they went and spied out the land, came back and said, they're huge, we're tiny, they're going to crush us, let's go back to Egypt. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. The great conquests of Joshua, nothing has changed. They're seeing with the exact same eyes. We need a Goliath-looking person to defeat all the Goliaths out there. So they're looking at the outward appearance. He's being described by all the things that the world loves. He's anointed king, and we do get a very short rise of Saul. We get a little defeating of the Amorites. There's sacrificing, there's rejoicing, there's renewal of the kingdom. Samuel comes and they celebrate after this one victory, but it is extremely short-lived. Immediately after, we see the Philistines show up. Israel is outmatched. Saul is told to wait for Samuel to sacrifice before they go into battle. He gets antsy and he doesn't wait for Samuel. He sacrifices himself to God, and then immediately Samuel shows up, rebukes him for not waiting, and we're already beginning to see the first kind of fruits of Saul trusts one person more than anybody else, and it's himself. He trusts what he can control. He trusts what he can get his hands on. He is not one who waits upon the Lord to renew his strength. And so we see this first moment of ceasing to trust the Lord, and then we just get this downward spiral of Saul. So Saul, through the whole book of Samuel, basically from this point on, he hasn't looked great thus far. He can't find his father's donkeys. He's outwardly beautiful, but inwardly we're going to see his poverty. He's going to be almost like Gollum in Lord of the Rings. I can do a Lord of the Rings reference because Lee's gone, so he won't correct me if I get it wrong. Gollum is just slowly corrupted over time. And just there's this downward spiral into madness. We are going to see that with Saul. He's going to be a picture of what does unchecked sin and self-centeredness and self-trusting result in someone. And he's going to show us that. So we're going to see this downward spiral. We're also going to see Saul is a model of he is a king like the nations. Israel asked for a king like the world, and they are going to get one. So 1 Samuel 14, there's this little seemingly throwaway verse. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. Let's keep that in mind because we're going to see it. David is the exact opposite. But notice Saul's description of anybody big and strong, anybody who's in the high society, he brings into his inner circle. Again, so he's got eyes just like the rest of Israel has. Those who look impressive, I want to bring close to myself. The opposite of Hannah's eyes. Okay, so we're going to see this downward spiral. In this battle with the Philistines, Israel's hiding in caves. It's not a battle. And Jonathan, Saul's son, who does have faith in Yahweh, goes with his armor bearer, begins to have victory in the battle. There's this quick defeat of the Philistines, and then Israel's army is marching, and Saul makes this kind of just rash vow, seemingly for no reason, in 1 Samuel 14. The men of Israel had been hard-pressed to that day. They've been fighting the Philistines. So Saul had laid an oath on the people saying, "Cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I am avenged of my enemies." Okay, so two things. One, notice how self-centered. No mention of Yahweh, no mention of Yahweh's enemies. We're not going to eat until my enemies are vanquished. Notice number two, that is dumb. You've got a hungry army, and you're saying, no food for you until we win this battle. You know what's going to help you win the battle? Food for the hungry bellies of your army. So just not strategically wise. So again, he's an incompetent king. And then Jonathan, his son, not hearing his father's silly vow, eats some honey. His heart is strengthened. Then Saul hears about it and wants to kill Jonathan, who's been the only one who's been bringing about the victory. Again, so the stupidity is just continuing. And Israel has to stop Saul from killing his own son, who is the only one who has been doing anything good in this whole story. Okay, so the downward spiral is beginning. It's only going to get worse. And then we see in 1 Samuel 15, Saul blatantly disobey God. They defeat the Amorites, and instead of devoting them to destruction like God commanded, Saul sees someone high, someone mighty, their king, and he attaches them to himself. He kind of wants to get buddy-buddy with the enemy king. Samuel shows up, rebukes him, kills the king that Saul should have killed, and then Samuel tells him, God has ripped away the kingdom from you. God will seek after a man from his own heart. There's somebody else that God is looking at that will care about trusting in him versus trusting in self. So again, the reign of Saul is going to continue, but the fall of Saul has already begun. It's going to get worse. And again, the summary of this section is Israel wanted a king like the nations. They got one. And we should know from Hannah's prayer, that doesn't go well. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled. So God, 1 Samuel 13, the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. God sends Samuel to Jesse's home. And he tells Samuel, one of Jesse's sons is the one I've chosen to be king. And Samuel goes to Jesse and says, bring me out all of your sons. And he brings out all but one of his sons. And they all look a lot like Saul. And Samuel, looking at them, thinks, okay, this must be the one. God says no. Okay, well, this must be the one. God says no. Until he goes through all the sons. And then he has to ask Jesse, is there not any more? And Jesse responds, oh, yeah. I mean, the youngest one who I didn't even think you would want to glance at, he's off in the field. Now, pause. Let me defend David. David is called beautiful multiple times. He's actually called beautiful more than anybody else in the scriptures. Just a fun side note. Daniel has also killed a lion and a bear with his bare hands. Okay, so though he's not physically impressive like Saul, he's manlier than everyone in this room combined, okay? So let's not think like David's wimpy, okay? So just side note. But finally, Jesse brings David, and God very clearly tells Samuel, do not look upon the appearance or the height, the stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees, okay? Man sees, we look at Saul and we're wowed. We look at Goliath and we're terrified. That's not how God sees. Man looks at the outward appearance. The Lord looks at the heart. Again, think of Hannah's prayer. It's the lowly. It's those in the dust. It's the forgotten one in the field that God actually exalts. Think about the New Testament. When God calls elders into the service of his church, are all of the scriptural requirements, they must be an awesome retired CEO. They have to be entrepreneur and really be able to build things and get things done. Is that anywhere in the requirements for elders? No. What is all the focus on, with the exception of they need to be able to teach character? They trust in the Lord. They're gentle with Jesus' sheep. Right? So you see that same sort of pattern playing out here with David. So God calls David, Samuel anoints David as king while Saul is still reigning. So David is getting, in a sense, a promise. It's not a coronation ceremony, but he's getting a promise. You will be king, and the rise of David begins from that point. And the rise of David is going to mirror the fall of Saul until his death. Okay, so David pretty instantly is kind of thrust into the scene. He has an almost Joseph and Daniel-like favor upon his life. Everything he touches turns to gold. So Saul is being tormented by an evil spirit, and David is called. And David plays the harp and the lyre, and it calms Saul's heart. And even Saul loves him. That's how it's first described, and has him come in as his armor bearer. David meets Saul's son, Jonathan, and Jonathan's heart is knit to him. David has the hearts of the ladies, as we'll see. Saul kills his thousands, David his tens of thousands. So everywhere Daniel or David goes, the favor of the Lord is upon him. So David's rise begins. He's this singer, poet, but then we get the story, maybe the most famous story in the Bible, other than the crucifixion, which is David and Goliath. Another story where the big bad Philistines have drawn up and the Israelites are terrified. But now there's an even more particular figure who is bigger than Saul, badder than Saul, a guy named Goliath, who is described with this serpentine, scaly armor. And he's mocking not just Israel, he's mocking their God. Mocking their God. David, the forgotten boy in the field, goes to bring his brothers some food. He's not even a part of the army. Goes to bring his brothers some food, overhears this, and much like Joshua and Caleb in the book of Numbers, just simply asks, why is no one going to kill this guy? Why are we allowing this blasphemy to happen? And everyone just says, be quiet, little boy. But he says, okay, well, I'll go do it myself. Why? Not because I'm awesome, but because the God that he mocks is awesome. So he goes and gets permission from Saul, gets the five smooth stones, draws up to Goliath. Goliath is insulted that this little runt would come up against him. My dog, you would come at me with sticks. And David kills him. Now, hopefully you know this by now. If you've been coming to Parkway for any amount of time, I think you anticipate what I'm about to say. We're in Jeremiah 29:11 territory, where you're like, okay, you're about to bash how this is typically taken. Let me just ask the simple question. Is the focus of this story on David? Let's read. Then David said to the Philistine, Goliath, you come at me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin. The great mighty things of this world, which Hannah's prayer would tee us up for something here. But I come at you with five stones and I'm really good with my sling. Is that what it says? No. Again, I know there's a series coming out on Amazon Prime. I'm sure they will highlight Yahweh's supremacy. But I come at you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. What should that make you think of? A scaly, giant enemy of God's people whose head is going to get crushed. Okay, Genesis 3:15. Bad guys get broken heads in the Bible, Jim Hamilton. And I will give your dead body to the host of the Philistines this day and the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth that are on the earth, that you may know that there is a God in Israel and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not Hannah's prayer, with sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's and he will give you into our hand. Okay, so what's David's focus? No, the Lord. God's going to wipe you out. And that's exactly what God does. One stone to the forehead. David runs up, takes Goliath's sword from him, cuts off his own head using an instrument of death to bring about salvation for the people. And then David's fame beyond this just absolutely skyrockets. He becomes a general in Saul's army, and he does win the hearts of the people. So again, Hannah's prayer, we're seeing the same theme over in David's rise. There's nothing special about David, except the fact that he was unseen and forgotten. It's God who is exalting him. And as soon as David's fame rises, we enter into this new section I've put in your notes, Saul versus David. That's a bit misleading because David is not going to be opposed to Saul. It's more kind of a Tom and Jerry situation of Saul pursuing David and David refusing to lay a finger on the Lord's anointed. Okay, so Saul is going to quickly descend into madness. He gets jealous when he hears the women singing. Saul kills his thousands. David kills his tens of thousands. There are several murder attempts. David serving Saul by playing the harp. Saul taking up a spear and tries to pin David to the wall, and he does it twice. And one of the things you would see, if you just trace Saul throughout Samuel's, he looks more and more like Goliath. He will always have a spear in his hand from this point on. He will have a javelin in his hand from this point on. He looks more Goliath-like as he just descends into madness. So he tries to kill David once. He then tries to scheme, offers his daughter for David to marry if he'll go kill a certain amount of Philistines, thinking the Philistines will kill David. And then David kills double that amount. And so every time Saul tries to have him killed, David just succeeds all the more because God's hand is on him. There's another murder attempt. And again, just think about the stupidity of Saul. There is no one in his kingdom bringing him more fame. There is no one in his kingdom bringing him more victory. There's no one in his kingdom bringing him more peace or prosperity than David. David is wiping out all of his enemies. David is charming his tormented soul. And Saul can think of one thing killing him. Why? Because of his pride. You're not just meant to see the corruption. You're meant to see the stupidity of what sin will do to you if you are at the center of your own life, if you are on the throne of your own heart. And so Saul tries to kill David multiple times. Saul tries to kill his own son when he perceives that Jonathan has sided with David. Saul does massacre a group of priests that he thinks has conspired with David, even though they haven't. So Saul is a madman at this point in the Samuels. He has descended into madness. He's killing anybody who gets in his way, including the people who are trying to help him the most. Okay, so we see this downward spiral, and then David flees. And so again, remember Saul, he's always attaching the rich and famous to himself. As David runs away, we get this description of David. 1 Samuel 22, "And everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to David. And he became the commander over them, and there with them about 400 men." So who is David drawing to himself? People with money problems. People with issues, right? Okay, so you see the parallel. Those who are like, bring me all the rich and famous, and those, bring me the needy. Again, who's that going to sound like when we get to the New Testament? Who is it that just seems drawn not to those who are high and mighty, but those who are forgotten? The sinners, the tax collectors. Okay, so you're seeing something about the character of this man. Okay, so David runs away. While he's running away, he's still fighting Israel's enemies. So he's doing what Saul ought to be doing as he's on the run from Saul. He's hiding in caves from Saul continually, pinning psalms as he's there, by the way. And twice he spares Saul's life. So Saul, taking things very much into his own hands, trusting in himself, David knows Saul is leading the nation terribly, knows Saul is killing people left and right, killing God's people left and right. Still, I mean, it's almost maddening to read, David refuses to touch him. Even when you could justify, like David's men do, the Lord's given him into your hands. Look, he came in here to go to the bathroom. Kill him, right? This is clearly the Lord's doing. They're reading into providence. God put him here. David refuses. In fact, David cuts off a piece of his garment and he gets convicted over it for not trusting in the Lord. So again, notice the parallel characters there. Self-trusting, I will wait upon the Lord. So he delivers Saul, or spares Saul multiple times. He ends up fleeing to the Philistines. At that point, Saul stops pursuing him, and he tricks the Philistines into thinking he's going to become a Philistine, all while he's going and raiding and destroying Israel's enemies. And so again, he's almost portrayed like this Joshua figure. Even while he's on the run, he is still cleansing the land of God's enemies. And then right at the end of 1 Samuel, you get these two parallel tragedies. And again, it's meant to parallel Saul and David's character. It's the absolute depths of Saul's fall. He perceives there's this great battle that's coming with the Philistines. And instead of going to God, he goes to a witch, a medium. And he has this, the witch of Endor, call up Samuel. It's a very strange passage. But notice what he's resulted to. He's dabbling in witchcraft, something that he was supposed to completely outlaw in order to get some guidance. And then right around the same time, David, his camp is raided. His wives are captured, him and all of his men, those men in debt, those lowly men that have attached him to himself. Their wives are taken. And then look at verse 30, First Samuel chapter 30. "And David was greatly distressed, and the people spoke of stoning him. So not only has David's family been taken away, but his closest men are now thinking, let's kill David. They don't know what to do with their own rage, and they're thinking they'll pour it out on their leader. Because all the people were bitter in soul for each of the sons and daughter, or for each of their sons and daughters that have been taken. And so what's David going to do? Is David going to say, whoa, hey, Goliath killer, anointed king, okay? Everyone calm down, don't worry. Is he going to draw a sword and fight them? Is he going to do something in and of himself? What does David do? Does he go to the witch of Endor? But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Okay, so again, you're seeing the vivid contrast between Saul and David. I mean, imagine that scenario. Everything you love gets ripped away from you, and those that are supposed to be, you know, in it with you now want to kill you. I'm going to go away and pray. I mean, would that be your impulse? David trusts in his God. He waits upon the Lord. He goes, God does bring them back, delivers them, and then into 1 Samuel, Saul is killed in battle. Saul actually kills himself. He knows he's going to be killed. He doesn't want to be killed by the Philistines. He falls on his own sword. And that's where 1 Samuel ends. Again, Hannah's prayer in 1 Samuel 2, the bows of the mighty are broken, but God will give strength to the king and exalt the horn of his anointed. Okay, so that's here. And then all of 2 Samuel is going to be David's reign. Sorry, I keep saying David, Daniel. So David in the first five chapters is made king. There's a little bit of a hiccup. Again, almost frustrating. You're like, David, you waited so long to be king. And then he's made king of Judah. And then Ishbosheth is made, one of Saul's sons, is made king of Israel. There's some murders and there's some battles. David still refuses to go and kill him, even though he's encouraged to do so. Eventually, someone else kills him, and David is made king over all of Israel in 2 Samuel 5, and we get this beautiful kind of triumphal reign of David. All these summaries of he establishes Jerusalem as the capital city. He's becoming greater and greater and greater, but I want to show you something. The author of Samuel, right when he's describing David's triumph, leaves us this little breadcrumb in 2 Samuel 5, and David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem. Now, the author, notice, if you read 2 Samuel, doesn't say, David married more wives, which is bad, don't do that. It just tells you. It doesn't comment on anything. Now, I want to show you how the Bible expects you to read it. The Bible expects you've read everything that came before this passage. The Bible expects, in particular, you have read Deuteronomy 17:17, talking about the kings of Israel, and he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart be turned away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver or gold. Okay, so the author of Samuel doesn't take time to editorialize for you. David took concubines and wives, which is bad. That's a bad sign in the midst of this rise. What the author of Samuel expects is that you've read Deuteronomy 17 so that when you see that stated fact, you say, uh-oh, wait a minute. Doesn't Deuteronomy 17, which Deuteronomy 18 says the kings are supposed to write the law every single year, so David should know this passage, doesn't that say he shouldn't be doing this? So you see how the Bible expects you to use what's come before to interpret what comes after. So there's little breadcrumbs of what we're going to see later that's going to lead to this fall of David. But we're still in the triumph. So he establishes Jerusalem. He defeats all the Philistines. He puts away kind of all the enemies. It's almost this sense of, the Joshua conquest actually happens. He then brings the ark into Jerusalem. He's dancing before it, wearing a priest's outfit. So you see, again, the first taste of this unification of priest and king that we'll see developed more throughout the scriptures. He's dancing before it. He's reestablishing not just peace in the land, he's reestablishing worship in the land. And then in 2 Samuel 6, 8, and 10, we get all these stories of victory and essentially just prosperity. You get a picture almost of the Garden of Eden. God's people are in the land worshiping their God with no enemies. The enemies have been pushed out. All they're doing is praising and rejoicing God. They have a land, they have their God, they have the people together. And then it dawns on David as he's, I think, realizing this, recognizing, hang on a minute, I live in this great palace. We have all these great prosperity, but God still is dwelling in a tent, right? The tabernacle. There's still this kind of mobile home we've had since Sinai, moving around. Why don't I build a temple, a permanent temple building for Yahweh in the middle of Jerusalem. And we get 2 Samuel 7, the Davidic covenant. So Sam Amati, who's a pastor and a biblical scholar, talks about this. 2 Samuel 7, it functions almost like an hourglass in the Old Testament. All the promises we've seen thus far are funneling to this passage. Everything we see from Genesis, from Abraham, from Israel, is all funneling to this passage. And everything we're going to see after this passage, all the prophets are going to be commenting on this promise that David is about to get. So he wants to build God a house, a temple. Nathan, the prophet, comes to him and says, that's great, but God is actually going to build you a house, meaning a dynasty, and gives the specific promise that you will have a son, and that son will sit on the throne forever. And that son will reign forever. His heart will never stop beating. His glory will never experience one iota of being diminished. It will only increase more and more and more and more. So all the Abrahamic promises, all of Israel's promises, all are going to be funneled into this Messiah king. And as we'll see as we keep looking through the Old Testament, the prophets are constantly pointing back, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, back to this Messiah king. Daniel, in Daniel 7 that we looked at last week, is pointing back to this Messiah king, this Son of Man, who is going to receive a crown from the Ancient of Days as he comes on the clouds before the living God. That's meant to bring up this passage in your mind. So this is really the center, if you will, of the Old Testament you have right at the height, and then the last story that I wish we had more time to go into that we get right before the fall of David is right after this great promise, you get this story of David and Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth, David just asks, is there anyone left from Saul's house? Is there anyone left from Saul's house? Which if you know anything about kings in the ancient Near East, the first thing you do when you become king is kill everyone who is related to the previous king. Kill everyone that could come and steal your throne. And the words come out of David's mouth, is anyone left from Saul's house? Now he keeps talking, but that would be the expectation. That would be our expectation. David is going to establish his kingdom by wiping out all of his political enemies. But the rest of that sentence is there anyone from Saul's house that I might do good to? And he finds Mephibosheth, who is not just a nobody from nowhere. He is crippled. He's lame, and David calls him before him, and not only does he spare his life, but he says, for the rest of your life, you will be a son to me, and you will sit at my table, and you will eat the spoils of the king, and it will be as if you are of me. And we'll come back to that in a little bit, but that's the last story we see, again, the kind of king that David is, and the ultimate kind of king that his promised son will be, who pardons rebels and invites them to his table. Okay, so that's the great height of David. That's usually where our memories of 1 and 2 Samuel stops. We're not really that familiar with the rest. The rest is terrible. So immediately after this great height, as if to remind us, do not put your hope in man. Do not put your hope in any of Adam's children. We see this story in 2 Samuel 11 of David and Bathsheba. When he should be at war, he goes out to his balcony. He sees Bathsheba bathing on her roof. He knows who she is. This isn't a random stumbling. Jerusalem's not that big. Bathsheba's grandpa is one of David's closest advisors at Ahithophel. He knows who she is. He probably watched her grow up. So this isn't a stumble of lust upon a random naked woman that he sees. This is perhaps premeditated. It's certainly thought through. As he goes out and looks at her, he asks his servants to go get her. His servants remind him, isn't that Uriah, one of your closest soldiers' wife? And he says, go get her. And he sleeps with Bathsheba, and she becomes pregnant. He tries to cover it up. He can't, and when he can't, he has Uriah killed in battle, and then he keeps that hidden for a while. Forgetting that God sees all things. And Nathan the prophet comes and tells him a great story of a man who had all these goats and lambs and sheep. He was rich, and then there was a poor person with one little bitty lamb, and the rich man had a great party, and instead of taking any of his sheep to kill, he took the one little lamb and killed it, and David, enraged, says, who is this man? He deserves death, and Nathan says, you're the man. And then Nathan tells him, what have you done? The sword will now never depart from your home. And for the rest of 2 Samuel, the rest of David's life, we see the sword never departs from his home. We see gruesome, terrible stories. We see one of his sons sexually assault one of his daughters. Amnon sexually assaults Tamar and then does away with her. Absalom, another son, Tamar's brother, kills his brother Amnon and then flees. David is extremely passive. Long gone are the days of David and Goliath. He's really passive and weak and a little pathetic for the rest of the story. Absalom, his son, then leads a rebellion. David has to flee. David goes into exile, if you will. And then by God's grace, Absalom is killed. He's brought back. He pardons his enemies. And then we see another rebellion, Sheba's rebellion in 2 Samuel 20. Okay, so notice this triumph has turned again to total chaos. His life, for the rest of his life, is total chaos. And again, you're meant to see just the ripple effects of sin. We saw it very vividly with Saul. We're seeing it again with David. Again, David, none of this is on David's mind as he's on his balcony looking at Bathsheba. He thinks he's in control. He all of a sudden becomes self-trusting. And so again, Hannah's prayer is still true, even for David. The mighty who trust in themselves will be humbled. Okay? And again, Samuel reminded you, yes, judges, Israel needs a king. But Samuel is now telling you, Israel needs a perfect king. Israel needs someone better than even this great king. And then the final chapters, 21 through 24, function as a chiasm. We don't really have a time to go into it, but a lot of summary chapters. We see final wars in chapter 21. We see David's song of deliverance, chapter 22. That's the song. It is Psalm 18. But it mirrors Hannah's prayer. They kind of form the theological bookends. Then we see David's last words, his kind of last prayer, and then a summary of his mighty men. Very impressive warriors. And then lastly, we get the story of David's census. David goes and counts his army, which seems a little weird that God would get so upset. But what he's doing, again, is he's not becoming David with five smooth stones. I've got Yahweh on my side, therefore I'll beat Goliath. Now he's saying, what are my numbers? I want to take a look at my own might, and I want to see, okay, how can we fare? Again, his eyes have now drifted down to himself, and so God rebukes him for this. God brings judgment for this, and God brings deliverance from the judgment, and that is how the book ends. We see David, and he's trusting the Lord, but imperfectly. He's given options of what would you like, God says, how would you like this judgment to be poured out? And he chooses God to do it with plagues because he wants to trust in the Lord to bring it about. And it ends with him building an altar. This story that, again, seems almost random. He's building an altar, but he's building an altar where the temple is going to go. Okay, remember 2 Samuel 7 is the high point of this book, the building of the temple that will come with Solomon, not David. God tells David, no, you're a man of blood. Through your son, actually, I'm going to build this temple. He'll be a man of peace. And so it ends with David building an altar where the temple is going to be built. Okay, and so that's the end of this wild, wild book. The theological significance, we've talked about Hannah's prayer. God humbles the proud and exalts the lowly. The greater biblical theological point is, again, coming out of Judges, Israel needs a king. 2 Samuel says, okay, here's the answer to that question. Then the result of 1 and 2 Samuel is Israel needs a perfect king, and 2 Samuel 7 promises one. We need a king far better than Saul. We need a king far better than David, and one is coming. That's 2 Samuel 7. The rest of the Bible will keep pointing back to this promised one. So how does 1 and 2 Samuel point to Jesus? Again, it's fairly more obvious than what we've seen particularly. He is the promised son of David. Matthew goes to great lengths in his first chapter to link Jesus to David, his father. He is the one that will come and he will crush the head of the greater Goliath. He's the one who will have the even greater reign that will never end. Jesus also is the one, like David and Mephibosheth, who looks at those who are worthless, who are forgotten, who are lame, who can provide nothing to him except the threat of rebellion, and takes them, you and I, and puts them at his table, extends mercy to them, extends grace to them, extends his inheritance to them in a way that makes you stand back and say, who am I that I would deserve a God like this? That's what Mephibosheth says to David. Who am I that you would look upon me like this? That's what we say confronted with the reality of the gospel. Who am I, creature made from the dirt, that you, O God, would send your son to live my perfect life on my behalf, to die and take the penalty that I deserve, and to sit at your table for all eternity? And then lastly, perhaps the most forgotten connection, I think Matthew's genealogy does connect Jesus to David, but connects Jesus to David in a very particular way. He is the son of Solomon, born from Bathsheba. No. What does Matthew say? Born from Uriah's wife. In a genealogy, which is meant to be your resume, right before the resume of the Messiah coming out in Matthew 1, what does Matthew very weirdly highlight? David's sin with Bathsheba. David's murder of Uriah, as if to say, this is a Messiah who is not going to be in the high echelons of society. This is a Messiah that comes to save great sinners. This is a Messiah that comes to die for spectacular sins, like the one we see with David and Uriah's wife. Praise God for this book. Let me pray. We will sing praise to the Lord, the Almighty, the King of creation, and then DJ will come up with some questions. By the way, before I pray, there are two books I have for you to give away. I'm trying a different tactic. They're back there next to Carl. Carl, will you raise your hand? That's Carl, everyone, back there. The books are on that counter next to Carl, so that you who don't like to raise your hand in front of other people and expose yourself as, you know, being, it's too extrovert for you, be like, I would like that book. They're back there for you to go take after. Okay, so two books. One, Enjoying Your Prayer Life by Mike Reeves. Incredibly good book that shows you what is the heart of prayer, communion with the living God. And another, What is a Healthy Church Member? That shows, I think, just the wonderful heart of what is membership and how are you meant to, in a healthy way, function in the church. I believe the deacons are reading through that right now, or will soon, or something like that. So anyway, those are back there for you. So the more introvertedly inclined, go take those. I won't even look to see who it is, okay? But you are promising to read it and talk to somebody about it. Okay, let me pray. Father, we love you. Thank you that we can, like Mephibosheth, look back, just stand back and say, who are we that you would look upon us with this grace? Who are we that we in this story are not David? We in this story are Saul. We are Eli's sons. We are so quick to trust in ourselves. We are so forgetful of your salvation. We are so quick to just look at how you can benefit us. And yet time and time and time again, you're so patient with us. And you didn't just keep telling us to do better. You sent your son to do perfectly on our behalf. We praise you for the promise of 2 Samuel 7. We praise you that we get to look backward to see when he came in Jesus' first advent. We praise that we get to look forward to when he will come again and reign forever, and we will experience all the wonders of having King Jesus and seeing him face to face. We pray in his name. Amen.